looking for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great? The values... Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great? The values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. I'm Tom Hartman, pleased to be here with you today. The Democrats asked their question of the day on Social Security. It's incredible. You know, the Republicans send out their talking points, and you can see the script for every conservative radio talk show in America. You get on the email list for the Republican talking points. The Democrats send out a paragraph. Come on, Democrats, get it together. Anyhow, it's a good paragraph. So, exporter of finished goods to being the world's largest importer of finished goods. We've gone from being the world's largest importer of raw materials, you know, things like trees and raw material, you know, ore to make steel, things like, to being the world's largest exporter of raw material. We are now exporting trees and paper pulp and scrap paper and, you know, that, I mean, this is literally a definition of it. They call them banana republics because they export bananas. You export raw materials, you're a banana republic. You export finished goods, you're Japan. Or what is euphemistically known as an industrialized nation. We no longer are. Thanks to Reaganomics. Well, Margaret Thatcher, when she was the Prime Minister of England, pushed, and the Conservatives held the House of Commons, Parliament, did a bunch of things which led to the rise of Labour, which led to the rise of their equivalent of our Democratic Party, and Tony Blair and his substantial longevity, actually. People keep looking back at Margaret Thatcher going, don't want that to happen again. Oh, no. So anyhow, one of the things that Margaret Thatcher did was she said, let's take this pension program that we have here in the United Kingdom, their equivalent of Social Security, and let's split a piece of it off and make it private. So here, the Democratic question for the day. What has Britain learned from this, right? Here's how the Democrats phrased it. How has Britain's private pension system been impacted by administrative costs? Here's the answer. This is from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And I quote, more than 40% of individual accounts are eaten up by administrative costs. An analysis of Britain's private pension system found that a substantial portion of the private accounts are eaten away by administrative costs. Over a typical career and retirement, the current level of charges in the United Kingdom would reduce the value of an individual account by 43% relative to its value with no charges. In other words, more than 40% of an individual account's value is dissipated through fees and charges. This figure is based on actual data from financial providers, and reflects a comprehensive treatment of costs associated with individual accounts. End of quote.
Yes, we have a great idea for you here, friends. All you have to do is privatize your Social Security, give the money to my good friends on Wall Street who support my candidacy and those of all the other Republicans. And don't look at that 40% behind the curtain, please.
Oh, my. And then we get the Frank Luntz memo. This the hot thing in the blogosphere. We'll get to that in a minute. It's worth attending to. But first, George Bush was in Germany yesterday in Mainz, a city that I often took the train through. I've never been in, but on the way from Steinach, where I lived, we'd go through, up to Köln, which we often visited, and of course up into northern Europe. You'd take the train across the country through Würzburg and into Frankfurt, and then north up along the river Mainz, and of course there's the city of Mainz. So there, Bush was going to have one of his town hall meetings. These have been such successful PR events here in the United States, where you see these beautiful camera shots of, keep in mind, this is the 7 day a week, 52 week a year, 365 day a year campaign. Every single day there has to be something positive appearing about the Republicans and ideally the president, because he's got the major Republican bully pulpit. Whether it's real or not doesn't matter. You got to get the good visuals on TV. And so he's been doing these, and by the way, Frank Luntz points this out, as I said, we'll get to that. And so he's been doing these gigs that are not unlike the ones he did before the campaign. Before the campaign, the media sort of justified the bizarre nature of these things by saying, well, these are campaign appearances, where only people who signed loyalty oaths could get in, only people who were, you know, registered Republicans, donors could get in. The questions were pre-screened in advance. The people who were asking the questions were pre-screened in advance. Very often they were rehearsed in advance. Bush knew the question that was coming. He already knew the answer he was going to give. And they are presented to the public and to the news media as the president gets down and dirty with the folks. The president is having a conversation with the people. The president is having a town hall meeting. But in fact, it's a performance. It's a staged performance so that particular talking points can be made in a soundbite fashion that will look really good. And these people are used as props willingly because they, you know, they're gung-ho for the Republican Party. Either they are multimillionaires or they are deluded. And, the message gets out there. So Bush was going to do the same thing in Germany. And Condi did it a month or two ago when she was over there. 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago. This must have been their test. And Condi Rice went over, and she had one of these town hall meetings in Mainz. And it's a M-A-I-N-Z. They, in German, you pronounce a Z as if it was T-Z. Zid. So it's Mainz. Anyhow, it went over there, and because I've been hearing this mispronounced all day long in the news, it's in any case, Condi went over and said, let's rehearse this thing. And they pre-screened the questions, and there was one guy who asked several different questions, and they told him which of his questions he could ask her. There was one question he was going to ask about Iraq and Afghanistan. They told him that he could not ask her that. And these were people who were, you had to be, you know, 20 to 30 years old, working for a major corporation, you know, people who had a lot to lose if they screwed up and who would look good for their employers, working for big companies, you know, fresh scrubbed young faces, relatively young looking. Just exactly the props that you want. And it worked well for Condi, so they figured they could do the same thing for George W. Won't this be great? Well, it didn't quite work out. As Der Spiegel, which is the German equivalent of Time magazine, they have an online edition, which is in English, and they actually do a very good job of cleaning up the English. Because if you just, you know, you run German through a translating machine, the syntax is different. The verbs go at the end of the sentence, and there's, you know, all these different. It's a very, well, I guess any foreign language has its own idiosyncrasies. How can you say any language is idiosyncratic compared to English? I mean, English, I guess, is along with the Asian languages, particularly Chinese, one of the most difficult to learn. But in any case, the much-touted American-style town hall meeting, this is from Der Spiegel, the White House had been planning with, quote, normal Germans, end quote, of every walk of life, will be missed during his visit to the Rhine River hamlet of Mainz this afternoon. This was yesterday's news, of course. A few weeks ago, the Bush administration had declared, or yesterday's story from the Der Spiegel, a few weeks ago, the Bush administration had declared that the chat, which could have brought together businessmen, butchers, bank employees, students, and all other types to discuss transatlantic relationships, would be the cornerstone of President George W. Bush's brief trip to Germany. This is what the German people were told. It's going to be the cornerstone of his... Get excited, folks. Average people are going to get to talk to George. The mistake the Germans made, they believed he really meant it. I mean, they actually took him seriously. Well, State Department diplomats said the meeting would help the president get in touch with the people who he most needs to convince of his policies. This is the story that they heard, and they believed it. Pardon me. Bush's invasion of Iraq and his diplomatic handling of the nuclear dispute with Iran has drawn widespread concern and criticism among the German public, and during a press conference 2 weeks ago, Bush said Washington is still terribly misunderstood in Europe. All the more reason it would seem for him to be pleased about talking to people here, writes Der Spiegel. But on Wednesday, the town hall meeting will be nowhere on the agenda. It's been canceled. They say, why? What's the explanation? Well, again, I'll quote from the Time magazine of Germany, Der Spiegel. The White House got cold feet. Bush's strategists felt an uncontrolled encounter with the German public would be too unpredictable. To avoid that messy scenario, Der Spiegel writes, the White House requested that rules similar to those applied during Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's visit 2 weeks ago also be used in Mainz. Before meeting with students of Paris's Academy of Political Science, which preens the country's elite youth for future roles in government, Rice's staff insisted on screening and approving any questions to be asked by students. So that had worked for her. But the Germans, however, insisted that a free forum should be exactly that. Wolfgang Ischinger, Germany's ambassador to the United States, told the New York Times, we told him, don't get upset with us if they ask angry questions. Right. So Bush's handler said, no, we won't get upset. We're just getting out of town. Oh, my. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We voted on machines without a paper trail. Whoever brought us those touch screens ought to go to jail.
That's a plan.
No more hanging chads, no more democracy. What's lost is lost, we have been had, screwed so thoroughly. Coup d'etat, oh coup d'etat, here we go again. Ohio and Florida, where cheaters go to win.
And welcome back. 25 minutes after the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix. Yes, are you going to take the red pill or the blue pill? Newt Gingrich, boy, you know times are bad. You know it. Hunter S. Thompson's marvelous saying, when the times get weird, the weird turn pro. Well, Newt Gingrich is warning Tom DeLay about ethics. And as Craig Hines notes in the Houston Chronicle, talking with Newt Gingrich about ethics may be like talking to Willie Sutton about bank robbery. You listen carefully to such an experienced practitioner, but you wonder, if he's so smart, why'd he get caught so often? Here's what Gingrich told the Christian Science Monitor over a journalist breakfast.
Republicans in the House have to look at the reality that if we make sense as a party right now, it's because we are the Reform Party, and anything that risks being the Reform Party is more dangerous for us than it is for the Democrats.
Gingrich told the journalist breakfast that
they should be very careful,
speaking of the Republicans. Be very careful. Be the party of reform. And last year, you'll recall, when the Republicans tried to change the House rules so that Tom DeLay wouldn't get nailed for being a sleazoid, they were going to do it. They were going to change those rules. And Gingrich spoke up. Gingrich opined. And this guy, who has delivered divorce papers to two wives just as they were diagnosed with fatal diseases. The second one, while he was getting it on with his intern or secretary or whatever there in the House of Representatives, at the same time that he was heading up the impeachment of Bill Clinton. Go figure.
Oh, it's so immoral.
Anyway, I a lot you could do with that. I'm not going to. Delay, though, sometimes through House Speaker Dennis Hastert has extracted revenge against the House Ethics Committee. So delay sort of goes along. He says, okay, I'll let you kick me upside the head and point out that he, you know, delay said that he would let them point out that he was a soulless. But let's say that he inhaled too much bug killer in his previous job as a what do you call it? Bug killer, exterminator. But after they did it, he got him back. So they did what Newt said. You know, they followed. But as a result of subsequent changes in House rules, notes Craig Hines in the Houston Chronicle, as a result of subsequent changes in House rules, it's now harder to institute an ethics complaint against a member. Hastert also replaced the fair-minded chairman of the House Essex Ethics Committee, the Republican from Colorado, Joel Helfley, with a leadership stooge, that is to say, somebody beholden to Tom DeLay. Representative Richard Doc Hastings of Washington replaced two of the Republicans on the panel. Two of the newly appointed members, including Representative Lamar Smith, a Republican from San Antonio, have been contributors to DeLay's legal defense fund. And if DeLay's message wasn't clear enough, Hastings fired the two long-serving senior committee staff members who were, in effect, the panel's institutional memory. So, Tom DeLay, of course, getting more and more corrupt as the day is getting longer as we now move into summer. At the same time, Newt saying, look out. Well, Frank Luntz has some very specific suggestions and advice for the Republicans. His 160-page playbook is out. I'll share a little bit of that with you. Our number, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to opine, TomHartmann.com for the website.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartmann.
We've seen it all before. We know what it's all about. He lied to get us into war. He'll lie to get us out. Fool us one more time, like no one's keeping score. Election fraud should be a crime. Don't let them do it anymore.
And welcome back in the Darwinian world of ideas. We're at the top of the food chain here on the Tom Hartmann radio program. Welcome back, my friends. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, 26 minutes before the hour. And Israel in Sydney, Ohio on the line. Is that Israel, our trucker who's listening on Sirius?
Yeah, Israel. It's Israel.
Israel,
I call a few times.
Yeah, good to hear from you.
One complaint I got because I cannot hear anymore 3 hours unless I stay till 1 o'clock at night, and that's what happened last night.
So you heard the whole show on Sirius, yeah?
Yes. The problem that about starving the beast, upstate New York, Syracuse, Rochester, and especially Buffalo, really got problem. They wanted to raise taxes, but they cannot raise taxes because people don't have the money. So they're going to cut down now on government services. They have proposal to cut out on fire department, lay off these officers, fire all the nurses at schools. They cut down on service services like snow plowing. And the thing is that north of the border is pretty good, I mean, compared to Buffalo. It's crazy. Yeah.
Oh, it is, and it is the Star of the Beast strategy. I mean, this is the conservative strategy, and what it does is it produces a whirlpool. It's like water going down the drain in the bathtub. The economy of a nation is never static, Israel. It's as I'm sure you know, it's either going up or it's going down. And when you start cutting back on local services, you're also cutting back on the salaries of local people. So those firemen and police officers who get laid off, and snowplow guys who get laid off, and teachers who get laid off, they're losing their salaries. And that's going to mean that there are fewer jobs in that area. That means that there's going to be those people having less money. They're going to have less money to spend, which means that they're going to buy fewer things in the local area, which means that the local businesses are going to have less money, which means there's going to be less tax revenue from the businesses. There's going to be less tax revenue from the people who got unemployed. And as a result of that, they're going to have to cut some more. And then, it's like one of these. You're either spiraling up or spiraling down. And this country was spiraling up from the bottom of the Great Depression, say 1932-33, when Roosevelt flipped the conservative economics that had brought about the Great Depression on its head. And this country was spiraling up steadily all the way up until 1980, when Ronald Reagan became president. And we have been spiraling down ever since.
Correct. But here's the point that I want to make to everyone that listens to the program. Everybody that vote for his representative in Congress or in Senate or to the White House, they vote for representative to represent him to make his life better. Not the people in China or Afghanistan or India. They make life of people that live even here in America better.
Yeah.
Why they will go against the citizen? Why they hate so much the American people? I don't get it.
Why do they do that? Israel, it's not that they hate the American people. It is that for this very elite stratospheric, you know, the top 1%, for that class, which George Bush was born into and Dick Cheney earned his way into. And, you know, it's the American dream, right? At the extreme, I'd say the American dream is the middle class life. But in any case, that for that group to increase their power and increase their wealth, this is the way that they believe is most effective to do it. And in fact, it's true. We're seeing an explosion in wealth among the top 1%. 201% increase in after-tax income from the year Ronald Reagan became president to today among people in the top 1%, whereas it's only a 2 or 3% increase among the bottom 40, 45%. And so, you know, this is the way that they do it. On the one hand, it's not a zero-sum game. That is to say, there's not just a fixed amount of money. And if more of it goes to the rich, that means less goes to the poor. I mean, it's not entirely that. But there is a good chunk of that. There is an element of that. And so if the rich want to really get richer in a big way, they got to take it from the middle class. And that's what they're doing. This is class warfare.
Yeah, but what's going to happen? They're making other countries getting more developed on the account, because it's horse trading. They're trading technology from here to China and India.
Yep.
So what they're doing, they're taking this country down and raising up those countries.
That's right.
What they're doing is they're going against the American interest, against American people.
Right, and eventually it all balances out. They take Indian workers who are willing to work for $1 an hour, and they start working them for $1 an hour, and then Chinese, and then, you know, and then Malaysians, and then Vietnamese, and then Africans, and on it goes. It's going to continue around the world, right? They're going to keep on this search for cheap labor, and there's an almost unending supply. And in the meantime, the labor base in the United States is going to settle lower and lower and lower and lower and lower until, you know, basically you've got people in the United States working for the equivalent of $1 or $2 an hour, and people everywhere else in the world working for the equivalent of $1 or $2 an hour. This is like 30 years down the road from now. And it's all evened out. You see, you've got the 90% that is just the terrified working poor, and you've got the 1% that's the incredibly wealthy. And that is the situation that you see in these third world countries. I've worked in Colombia, for example, in Bogota and down in the Medellin Valley. And that's what you see. There are these incredibly wealthy families that own everything. They refer to it as oligarchy. And then there's everybody else who's, you know, terrified and basically the working poor. And that's the world that George W. Bush and his economic policies are moving us toward, and the World Bank and the IMF. And it's one of the reasons why he's getting a lot of pushback from the folks in Europe, as, you know, not just for his war policies, but also for his crazed economic policies. One of the reasons why Putin is pushing back, because Putin is saying, OK, you know, when we got rid of communism, We went full tilt boogie, just blew it right into Bush-style, laissez-faire, classic liberal is what it's called. It's not liberal in the way that we would use the word in the United States. The Europeans use the word to mean, the word liberal there means free for business. It means Bush-style economics. Right. It's got liberal economics, and it doesn't, we would call it conservative economics, and it doesn't work for the middle class. It does work for the most wealthy and the most powerful. And the most wealthy and the most powerful are the ones who are making the decisions, because the American people have been put to sleep by right-wing talk radio primarily, and by a media which is owned by these same corporations whose interests are being served. And until the American people wake up and figure out what's going on, and figure out who is really doing this to them, you know, things are not going to change. And so you and I become the agents of change, Ezreal. We're the ones who've got to get out there and tell people, hey, this is what's going on. These people, you know, the class warfare was declared 30 years ago by Ronald Reagan, and his class is winning. And is that the world that we want to live in? Or would we rather live in a world where there actually, yes, there is some wealth, some income redistribution, to quote the conservatives, as if it's a horrible thing, as if it's the, you know, Karl Marx's only idea or whatever. I mean, income distribution has been around for, redistribution has been around forever in various forms. Even in the feudal states, the lords figured out a way to give some of the benefits of the farming back to the serfs who worked the fields, you know. Anyhow, you got me going here. Ezreal, thanks for raising it. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good to hear from you. It's really bad.
Yeah, I know it is. And we've got to spread the word. We've got to wake people up, because it's going to get worse if we don't. Alan in Illinois on the line. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind?
Yeah, did John Kerry say in one of the debates that he was going to cut income tax altogether to people who make less than $200,000 a year?
I don't recall. I don't really care. I mean, the election's over.
Okay. What I was going to say is people would be crazy to vote for Bush, if that was true.
Because Kerry said he was going to cut taxes for the low-income folks?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I recall something like that, but Kerry just didn't do it well, or you could argue it's the media or whatever. You know, in fact, you could argue that Kerry won the election, and but that's a whole other discussion. But yeah, Alan, good point. Good point. And then that's the whole class warfare. And thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. And in fact, now the Republicans are talking to themselves about, you know, we actually do have to lie in order to maintain power. And here's how to lie. I kid you not. I kid you not. Frank Luntz, the guy who a couple of years ago came up with phrases like Clear Sky Initiative for a program that would reduce pollution controls and increase air pollution, and Healthy Forest Initiative for a program that would rape our national forests, turn them over to the big lumber companies, who were big contributors to the Republicans. Frank Luntz has come up, has done it again. He said, here's how we're going to win in 2006. This, by the way, has been outed in the blog over at thinkprogress.org, the Center for American Progress's blog, and it's working its way through the blogosphere. But one of the better jobs of breaking this thing out was done over there. As they note, for example, Social Security. Quoting from Frank Luntz now. Frank Luntz is the NLP expert who has been the advisor to the Republican Party going all the way back to, he helped Gingrich come up with the Contract on America. Quoting from Frank Luntz. As it stands now, Republicans lack factual discipline. Figures, dates, and even analogies are woefully all over the place. In other words, all the Republicans have to start singing from the same hymnal. And then he suggests, when you talk about Social Security, you have to lie. That when people suggest that the $2 trillion to privatize Social Security is just too much money, that's too expensive, we can't handle that, and it's not going to fix the problem anyway, the proper response that all Republicans must rehearse is, well, here's Frank Luntz. The perfect response is to show that, yes, we know that, and look at how doing nothing is much more expensive. From the LA Times on February 3rd, notes this blogger, a Bush aide briefing reporters on the condition of anonymity said that the individual accounts would do nothing to solve the system's long-term financial problems. But Luntz says, don't talk about that. On the tax cuts, Frank Luntz, he says, and I quote, see, what he's, before I tell you this, what he's saying is, even we Republicans know that this stuff is lies, that it's foolishness. He says, and I'm quoting Frank Luntz now, don't assert that the tax cuts caused the economic recovery. We have never found a Republican who has effectively made the case for strong economic growth as a result of a tax cut. It has been tried and tried and tried, and it just doesn't sound credible. This is quoting Frank Luntz. And in fact, to whatever extent there is an economic recovery, and I would argue that there may be a recovery in profits, there may be a recovery, you know, we may see more people employed right now, we may see the stock market up a little bit, we may see, you know, if you look at the surface, there seems to be recovery. Certainly times are good for the very wealthy. But because since about 1982 or 83, since the early years of the Reagan administration, the media has stopped reporting on labor issues and stopped reporting on the kind of incomes that people have and what's going on with the unions and all this kind of stuff. It's just stopped. We tend to think that how the rich are doing is how the economy is doing. And so everybody says, well, you know, the rich are doing better now. Companies are paying dividends. You only have to pay 15% income tax on that. The rich are doing better. I guess the economy's doing good. I say, tell that to most working people in America. Well, in any case, as the New York Times pointed out in an article on 8-12-04, this, again, from the thinkprogress.org blog, for every dollar spent on Bush's tax cuts, the economy only received 59 cents of economic stimulus. In contrast, quote, the economic bang for a dollar of aid to state governments is $1.24. Now, why would that be? Because you send that money down to the state government gets it to poor people spend it gets spent in the local economy supports entrepreneurs, those entrepreneurs hire those poor people. Those people now have a paycheck, they can buy more stuff, and boom, you've got that spiral up. Reversing the spiral down that Ezreal was talking about when he called in. So tax cuts to the rich, for every dollar a tax cut, you end up with 59 cents of economic stimulus. And I would argue it's probably even less than that. That's the assumption that they're investing all their money in the United States, and I'd say they're not. They're buying factories in China. But for every dollar of state aid to state governments, $1.34 comes back. Yet such assistance accounted for only 3% of the total cost of Bush's fiscal policies. Frank Luntz, recognizing this, is advising conservatives, this I'm quoting from the blog, to that quote, now quoting from Frank Luntz, instead of linking the current economic situation with tax cuts, you would be better off linking tax increases to future economic hardship. In other words, don't try to say tax cuts have caused a recovery to happen in the economy, because nobody's going to believe you. Even Republicans don't believe you. Instead, say the president must make these current tax cuts permanent, because if you don't, it's a tax increase. That is, we roll back to where we were. That's a tax increase. And tax increases will cause future economic hardship. And this is exactly what Ezreal was talking about and is being played out up in upstate New York. Trey in North Carolina on the line. Hey, Trey, welcome to the program.
I just want to call to agree with what you were saying. I tend to break it down in terms of, like, Wall Street versus Main Street.
Yeah.
And, the media always talks about how the economy is growing, but then they have these polls that say that they don't feel it. They don't feel the growth.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, like, of course the economy is growing under the Bush administration for Wall Street.
That's right.
Not doing so for Main Street.
There you go. Well said, Trey. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. Well said. It's absolutely right. Trey's got it nailed down. The economy is growing marvelously for Wall Street. And, of course, they're the ones who poured all kinds of money into Bush's campaign here, wanting privatized Social Security, but not for Main Street. Exposing the con and conservative. I'm Tom Hartman.
fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Coup d'etat, oh coup d'etat, here we go again. Ohio and Florida, where losers go to win.
And welcome back, 5 minutes before the hour. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Number Scott in Georgia on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to give you a very brief experience I had this past week. I was in Florida. I saw a business there where it was employing mostly minorities in menial type jobs, and the working conditions were poor. And so when I got home, I sat down and tried to find out who to address a letter to in Florida state government about those working conditions.
Right.
And what I noticed was that the Florida website really led me nowheres in terms of lodging a complaint about poor working conditions. And my first thought was, well, this is really no surprise, considering that this is Jeb Bush's state.
Yeah. And that it's the South. I mean, this is the whole, you know, it's slavery started down there, first of all, not in Florida,
right,
but in the South in general. And cheap labor has been the mantra of the South. It's why in 1947, the Republican House and the Republican Senate, when the Republicans finally in the election of 46, in 47, when they were sworn in, they took the House and Senate and they passed the Taft-Hartley bill, which gave the Southern states the ability to say no to unions. And Harry Truman vetoed it, and they ran it right back over his veto. They rolled back his veto. They had, the Republicans had enough control then, and it was the South. It was the South.
That's absolutely true. I'm blue collar. My wife is white collar, and if you're blue collar in the South, you are about 20 years behind the times. If you're white collar, they're competing with any place else in the country.
Yeah, and increasingly they're competing with India. Thanks a lot for the call, Scott. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Matt in Kansas on the line. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. Just wanted to talk a little bit for just a second about Social Security.
Matt, we've only got about 15 seconds left, so.
Okay, Tom, I know it's a big debate. I think people look at it the wrong way. Social Security is an insurance policy. What insurance policy do you own where you haven't seen an increase in the premium?
Yeah, well,
it's part of life.
There you go. And well, that, to the extent that there's inflation, that's real. There's
absolutely.
The insurance industry has invested heavily in the stock market. One of the reasons why the insurance industry is having problems and insurance premiums are going up is because the stock market burst. But yes, you're absolutely right, and you make a very good point. Social Security is an insurance program. In fact, a third of the people who get Social Security benefits are not getting pension benefits. They're not getting, retirement benefits. So that's the program. Anyhow, I'm Tom Harbin. Thanks for being with us.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to the Real Free Speech Zone, the Tom Hartman radio program. Our quote for the day from William Fulbright. In a democracy, dissent is an act of faith. Have the Republicans set the stage for 2006? They're the actors and we're the audience. What does Terry Schiavo have to do with death with dignity? When has the Constitution been null and void? And everything you know is wrong. When democracy has failed, a few of the things we're talking about today. Frank Luntz, we started with this whole issue of Frank Luntz, the Republican strategist and NLP expert, use of language expert, the fellow who has come up with most of the Orwellian newspeak kind of phraseology, who coached Newt Gingrich in his early years, helped him put together the Contract on America. And now he has a new 160-page playbook for the Republican Party to win the 2006 election, and it's a series of advices on how to lie to the American people, among other things, or how to misrepresent things, how to change the meaning of things so that people really don't get it. We talked in the last hour about some of the tax cuts, you know, how to lie about tax cuts, how to lie about Social Security so people don't get it. Here's a few more. Point number nine, key communication point number nine, lawsuit abuse reform. Well, first of all, that in and of itself is a framing device that, you know, that we're going to try and reform the abuse of lawsuits. So when the little guy, when the average person tries to stand up and say, you know, I've been harmed, I would like to seek redress, that's abuse. But when a corporation gives you a, you know, a three-page fine print contract with your credit card and says, you can't change anything in this, sorry. Or when you try and get a mortgage from the bank and they give you a 16-page standard agreement with statements like, under this agreement, I'm voluntarily surrendering my rights under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, or under, you know, this agreement may be terminated at any time without notice by the mortgagor, at 60 days notice, whatever. In other words, they can just pull the mortgage, and you have no rights. Well, that's not lawsuit abuse. That's simply corporations looking out for themselves. So anyhow, lawsuit abuse reform. Frank Luntz says to the Republicans, see, the cost of health care is a big issue. People are freaked out about it. And so his solution for how to deal with this pervasive concern that people have, legitimate pervasive concern that people have about the fact that health care costs are exploding, insurance costs are going up, everything, you know, it's just, he says, and I quote, from Frank Luntz's 160-page playbook, you must always explain how and why lawsuit abuse is driving up the cost of health care. Well, as one of the bloggers over at the American Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org, notes, good advice if only it were true, from yesterday's New York Times, and I quote, for all the worry over higher medical expenses, legal costs do not seem to be at the root of the recent increase in malpractice insurance premiums. By the way, this is what rational people have been pointing out for years, that the malpractice insurance premiums have been exploding because the insurance companies had, you know, and the nature of an insurance company is that it gets a lot of money and it sits on it and you know, pays out when it has to, but it's basically, it's got to have large reserves. What do you do with those reserves? You have to invest them to make as much profit as you can from them. And what did the insurance companies do with those reserves? During Bill Clinton's presidency, they invested them in tech stocks and they made out like bandits. Till 2001. And the bubble burst. And so now they've got to raise, if you have to raise insurance rates because they made bad investments. Anyhow, back to the New York Times. For all the worry over higher medical expenses, legal costs do not seem to be at the root of the recent increase in malpractice insurance premiums. Government and industry data show only a modest rise in malpractice claims over the last decade. And last year, the trend in payments for malpractice claims against doctors and other medical professionals turned sharply downward, falling 8.9%. And as we have heard, you know, many times from several different authoritative sources, including the Harvard University study, the total impact, the total cost of all the malpractice lawsuits and all, just the total litigation cost in this whole country, it always represents about 1% of the increase in health insurance, in health care costs over the last few years. Health care costs that have been going up 15, 20, 25% in some cases, depending on where you live in the country, every year. In the Frank Luntz, Keep Lying, It Works category from the thinkprogress.org blog. The blogger notes, never mind that President Bush's budget is the largest in American history, or that his first-term tax cuts are responsible for a larger portion of the federal deficit than any spending increases. Luntz says, hey, don't tell Americans the truth. Redirect their interest. This is the old magic trick, you know? Watch my right hand while my left hand pulls the switch or moves the lever that will make it possible for my other hand to pull the rabbit out of the hat. Americans still believe, Frank Luntz says. In fact, a caller to this program yesterday was talking about this. He says, well, I got all this pork barrel spending. See, that's the myth. Yes, there is pork barrel spending. That is not responsible for the huge budget deficits. It is a wart, wart on the butt of America, of the American budget. It's a, you know, it's not pleasant to look at. It's a problem. It shouldn't be there, but it is not the cause of the deficits. But Americans believe that it is because of 20 years, 30 years now of conservative propaganda. And so Luntz says, Americans still believe. Now, keep in mind, this belief that they have is not accurate. It's not true. But if people believe something, even though it's a lie, you got to keep hammering on it. Frank Luntz says, and quoting Luntz, quote, Americans still believe the primary cause of the deficit is wasteful Washington spending, not the tax cuts. So tell them Americans aren't taxed too little. Washington spends too much, end quote. You get this? Americans don't realize that Bush's tax cuts for the rich are the main cause for why we have these huge budget deficits. And because they have been successful in keeping this out of the press. Now, how would that happen? Could it have something to do with the fact that the rich who got the major benefits of the tax cuts are the ones who, by and large, own the corporations that own most of the media in America? You think that might have something to do with it? At least the very big media in America. You can tell I'm not angling for a job here on NBC. I suspect it could have something to do with it, yeah. So anyhow, he says, because Americans don't realize, essentially he's saying, because Americans don't realize that Bush's little flim-flam game with his so-called tax cuts that are actually tax deferrals are responsible for the budget deficit, then let's just keep feeding them this line that the problem is too much government spending. Why? So we can cut government spending. Why? So we can replace those government functions, those things that we the people have traditionally done for ourselves, things like Social Security and Medicare, so we can replace those with services provided by private corporations at a profit. Why? Because then the rich will get richer and richer and richer. The GOP has always been the party of the robber barons. They just didn't used to lie about it. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Brian in Fort Lauderdale, Florida on the line. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, it's a lot of interesting stuff that you're bringing up here. I work on yachts down here in Fort Lauderdale, and, you know, you would think that our industry would be the first to really get the benefits from, you know, the tax break for the rich and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
You were talking about a little while ago that, you know, people assume that if the rich are doing well, then the economy is doing good. But the yacht industry down here is just dead. And it's actually, I mean, for the past 3 years, it's just almost grinded to a dead halt.
Yeah. Now, by yachts, Brian, are you talking about a boat that costs between a couple hundred thousand and a million, or are you talking about a boat that costs between 5 and 30 million?
Between, I mean, yeah, 250,000 to, I just finished working on a boat that's about 40 million.
Yeah, and so I would suggest that probably most of the fall off would be on the lower end boats, recognizing that a lower end boat is $250,000 to $500,000, because those are the ones that are not the senior major Disney Eisner executive type boats. Those are the ones that were the you know, the middle management where they were actually going on a mortgage to get that kind of boat, or they're buying it on time, something like that. And it's really not the rich in America. It's the nouveau riche. It's the upper middle class. And they're taking a hit, too, right now.
It seems to be across the board, though. What I'm wondering, I mean, and we're all wandering down here. I mean, Fort Lauderdale is supposed to be the yachting central in the world, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's just unbelievable, all the boats that are down here.
Sure.
Never seen so much wealth in my life. But, you know, we're trying to figure out, I mean, what's your theory on it, Brian?
Why is the yachting industry not doing well in Fort Lauderdale right now? Could it be that Fort Lauderdale isn't fashionable anymore for the rich?
Maybe that's the case. Maybe it's changing. But what I've been wondering is if these guys are seeing the dollar fall right now, and they're sitting on their money.
So they're putting their money
waiting to see what's going to happen with the dollar.
Yeah, and well,
I don't know if that's at play or not.
You know, it could be. I would think, though, that when the dollar's going flaky, what you want to do is convert your dollars into something other than dollars, and converting them into a boat actually would make sense, because it's the same thing as converting them into euros. You know, the value of the boat's going to go up as the value of the dollars goes down. So I don't think that that's it, frankly. I don't have an answer for that. It's an interesting little factoid. And thanks for sharing it.
I mean,
you know, it would be interesting. Maybe somebody in some other part of the country could tell us, you know, is the boat, could it have to do with four hurricanes this year? Could it be that people are just spooked about Florida?
It could
be. The global warming is, they're starting to say, hey, wait a minute, this global warming thing is real, and we need to, you know, maybe the boating industry, maybe the yachting, maybe if Harriet's listening, I don't think she is, she's not in the chat room, she's in Seattle. I'd be curious to know how the yacht industry in Seattle is doing right now, for example.
Hey, thanks for what you're...
You're welcome, Brian. Thanks for the call.
Nice to hear from you.
I appreciate it. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Viagra for your brain. The Tom Hartman Program. I'm Tom Hartman here with you.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Zell Miller of Georgia called out. Chris Matthews of Harbaugh to a duel.
Ah, yes.
At sunrise in the town, choose your weapons. If it's pistols at 10 paces, I'd be interested in going. I do hope Matthews wins. That would be cool.
Welcome back. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and it is time for our report from Washington, D.C., from Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen.
Well, it's very interesting. I'll talk about Putin in just a second, but Morris Hinchey, who is a member of Congress from New York, has said that he thinks that there is evidence, both circumstantial and other, that Karl Rove is the one that released those, the White House wrote those CBS documents that were famous with Dan Rather.
Yeah, I'm of the same mind.
Now, what's very interesting, I don't know if I said on your show or said on Doug's show, I can't remember, but at the time all this happened, I said, you know what's so interesting is why is it that the White House would release papers from a news organization?
Yeah.
That's the White House doesn't do things like that.
Yeah.
News organizations do things like that.
Yeah.
And I thought it was very, very strange at the time. I commented on it, and something struck me as very, very fishy.
Yeah, this was all very well orchestrated by the Bush campaign. You're familiar with the theory of Roger Stone's involvement?
No.
Okay. Well, we don't have time to get into it right now, but
plug
Roger Stone and that stuff into Google, and you'll find Daily Kos did a great piece on it a couple days ago. I ranted about it on a Randy Rhodes show, I think on Tuesday, and on my show as well. And it's Stone was the guy. Well, it's a whole long thing. Anyway, you have other news. What's up with Putin?
Okay. The other news, of course, is that, Putin is definitely back in the fold, my friend.
Oh, yeah. So there,
as you know, the White House came up with many agreements that they came. Putin at this press conference said that the commitment to democracy is irreversible. But we really don't know what happened in his private meeting with the White House, with the president, and what happened with the issues of freedom of the press, et cetera. So now, together, they're announcing these new nuclear security measures in terms of how they can secure facilities. They've also pledging now some energy cooperation. Not exactly sure what that means, but they're going to continue their dialogue, diversify energy supplies, et cetera. And then the United States is going to continue for the Russian inclusion in the World Trade Organization, and they're going to work for Russia's ascension into that. So that's going to happen, and that's pretty much what they agreed to.
Yeah.
Also, Karl Rove this afternoon is going to host a session with some business representatives. The group is called COMPASS, the Coalition for Modernization and Preservation of Social Security. And as you know, of course, they're already running, it's not COMPASS, but that USA group,
yeah,
that Art Linkletter is the spokesperson of, is running all these terrible ads comparing AARP as supporting gay rights.
They've got Art Linkletter on their side?
What?
They've got Art Linkletter on the
side? Their spokesperson. You got it.
Oh, my goodness.
Republicans say the darndest things.
Well, he went over the edge when his daughter committed suicide on they thought that she was on acid. You know, this was 20
years ago.
And he went to the dark side. I don't think he ever recovered from that. That's a shame to hear, because he was those of us old enough to remember him when we were little. He seemed like a decent guy, but what a shame. Well, the thing with Roger Stone, you're going to want to check it out. The guy down in Texas who got the papers, there was this Hispanic woman who called him and told him that he had to burn them to protect her honor, and that she was going to give them to him. And then a guy shows up and hands them off to him. And the speculation is that Stone's wife is Hispanic, and that she's the one who made the call, and that Stone was the one who made the delivery, maybe. And that Stone, you know, has been involved in forgery of documents before, and he studied under Don Segretti, who's the guy who nailed Ed Muskie with forged documents, in the Manchester Union Leader and all that. And it just all
these guys just change places, but their tactics never change.
That's right. And Stone also was the campaign advisor for Al Franken and gave Franken the cue to take out Howard Dean by saying that Dean didn't have enough blacks in his administration in Vermont. He'd been a Republican for years and years, and suddenly he's advising Franken, and now he's back being a Republican. Anyhow, Ellen, thanks a lot. Talk Radio
Thank
News
you.
Service, Ellen Radner, 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to chat room, my producer, everybody. It was Al Sharpton, not Al Franken. And poor Ellen, she's off the phone now. She's probably scratching her head going, what the heck is he talking? My apologies to my colleague Al Franken in the talk radio business. I meant Al Sharpton that Roger Stone is advising. Anyhow, welcome back, my friends. 1-866-889-8894. In just a moment, we're going to tell you something that you didn't know was right or wrong. But first, let's take a couple quick phone calls here. Scott in San Diego on the line. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. Good morning to you from sunny Southern California. Finally, we're getting some sun out here.
Finally sunny, eh?
It's nice. I can hear the water dripping down through the layers of earth, however. It's rained a lot.
Our oldest daughter was out there last week in Los Angeles, and she lives in Atlanta. She said, I thought we had left the tornadoes behind.
We're getting tornadoes here. I've never seen them before.
I know. It's a
new feature of Bush's climate change.
Yep, there you go. Welcome
you
to
go.
The wonderful world of climate change.
One more thing, Tom, really quick before I make my comment. I understand you're coming to San Diego. When will you be out here?
Yeah, I'll be out there. I'm flying out next Thursday. Right after I get off the air, I'll be doing the show from there Friday morning. And then Friday night, I'm giving a talk at the Church of Today, I think it's called.
You're going to be at the Church of Today?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, you're welcome.
Okay, here's the comment. I noticed something. Last night it was during a show about Bryce Canyon on HDTV that they were talking about this guy who was mentioning that Butch Cassidy had lived in the area and that, in general, the neighbors regard him fairly well because he robbed from the rich and gave to the poor. So he had very little animosity and supposedly never killed anyone. And I recall that two other men did the same thing. I call them princes of the poor. Jesus Christ did that by taking something valuable from the wealthy to give it to the poor. And again, Robin Hood did the same thing by taking something from the wealthy and giving it to the poor.
It's an old archetype. It's an old archetype.
It's an old archetype, and they all have a female model with them that provides a balance or a holistic approach of a man-woman approach. And I'm noticing these events occur most often when we have a repressive government or the rich are controlling. Butch Cassidy was responding against the robber barons in the West, and that's why he was stealing from them.
Yeah.
Same thing with Robin Hood, as he stole from the manor-born to give back to where it belonged.
That's right.
And, of course, Christ stole far more than money, if we can call it money, it's blessings. But those are all taken from the, quote, rich and given to the poor. And I notice that always happens under wealthy administrations. Who's going to be our new Robin Hood? You, maybe?
No, not me. But, you know, the point is that historically what the Democratic Party and progressives and populists have stood for is a leveling, not a communist style, not a Marxist style, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs, style of leveling, because that then you end up with government tyranny. But there is a certain point beyond which, and Jefferson actually was very eloquent about this, who people think of as, you know, he a small government, free trade kind of guy. But he was very eloquent, and he spoke many times in his letters about it. I have a chapter about it in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? That there is a certain point when individual wealth becomes so great and so concentrated that it actually represents a threat to a democracy.
Franklin wrote about that too, didn't he?
I'm not sure.
There was theory of patent, why he didn't get any patents, because he felt that
stealing. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, and Jefferson
approached the same concept.
Yeah, and Jefferson didn't think that that patents should be allowed for the same reason, that they didn't want people to be able to accumulate vast wealth. But Jefferson also argued that there should be essentially an inheritance tax to prevent that from happening. And none of that founding generation, none of them left behind fortunes. In fact, the laws in the United States, I don't think Hancock did, but the rest of them, most of the rest of them did.
Wasn't Jefferson bankrupt when he died?
He was totally bankrupt. And George Washington didn't have enough money to free his slaves when he died, or he freed a few of them, but not all.
Yeah, he only freed a few, but he couldn't free all of them, and he freed a few. And I understand that both of them, including the first four presidents, actually gave up their pay to be in the position. They weren't paid, or if they were paid at all, they were paid very poorly.
Yeah, I know that was the case with Washington. I'm not sure about the rest of them, but
I could have sworn Jefferson also went without pay.
Yeah,
I know that Franklin's adventures over to France were without pay.
Yeah, although he was compensated in other ways. Franklin was having a good old time, but he was a fairly wealthy guy by that time. He had his printing business going.
Well, he's my hero.
Yeah,
I love Franklin.
Yeah, Franklin.
Tom, I got to say one more thing before I go.
Sure.
Thank you so much for your newsletter.
I
already knew by the second paragraph what you were talking about, but it's shocking. I think that needs a whole lot more discussion.
Well,
it really chilled me to the bones, Tom.
That's where I'm going in 5 minutes. Let me just clean up the phone lines here, and we'll get to it.
Thanks
a lot. Okay,
bye.
Good to hear from you, Scott. I appreciate the call. Xavier in Santa Cruz is on the line. Hey, Xavier, what's on your mind?
Hi, good morning, Tom. Before I get to my question, I wanted to briefly comment on that last caller. If I'm not incorrect about my history, I think pirates got a bad rap, too. Is it true that they actually kind of stole from the rich and gave to the poor?
Well, it's interesting. A friend of ours is writing a book about pirates, and she's a pro-pirate book.
Mm-hmm.
And she's convinced that certainly in the early days that many of the pirates were responding. It was essentially the only way to make a living. You know, it was that they were responding to just incredible poverty. There were, however, certainly a lot of pirates, particularly the Barbary pirates that Jefferson struggled with, and Adams struggled with, who were just cutthroat, awful people. So it spanned the spectrum, just like I suppose, you know, the Sundance Kid, you know, going against the robber barons. There were also people who were just thieves. You know?
Okay. Well, my question was about what you're talking about today, Frank Luntz. Is it a book?
No. It's a 160-page document that he's put together for the Republicans on how to lie to the American people. I mean, he doesn't call it that. I would call it that.
Is this meant for common, for open publication?
No. It got leaked by somebody on the Daily Kos blog site.
And, is it available?
Luntz is apparently totally flipped out about it.
Is it available to the to the public, though?
Yes.
I can turn this over to people, Republicans, to show them what they're about, and it would basically blow the lid off of things?
That's right, yeah, and it's being done. Go over to thinkprogress.org, the blog for the American Progress, Center for American Progress, a lot of discussion about it. There are links to it off our message board. Somebody in our chat room earlier had put the link in the chat room. It's all over. You'll have no problem finding it. It's all over the blogosphere. So.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for calling, Xavier. Yep. Good to hear from you. And Armin in Florida is on line two. There we go. Hey, Armin.
Hey, brother.
What's up?
I want to ask you a question about Putin, but first, I want to ask you something. Why don't you frame it like this when Bush talks about taxes? Every dollar that he increases the budget deficit is a tax increase of a dollar.
Well, it's not a tax increase of a dollar. It's a tax increase of about $2, because over a 20-year
right.
period with compound interest, which has to be paid back,
right?
It's that, what I've been calling it is a tax deferral. It's a tax on future generations.
Right.
It's a birth
but,
tax.
But people don't understand the deferral, you know, the average people out here that follow the Bush crime
family. I think the suggestion that it be called a birth tax is an excellent one. What we have right now is we have a $600 or $400 billion budget deficit. You toss in the Social Security surplus that's being used, it's about a $600 billion budget deficit. It's really a $600 billion birth tax.
Well, our tax increase.
No, but it's a birthday. Every child that's born, owes $25,000 towards that, more or less. It's a birth tax.
I understand, but if you take them too far, you lose them. The average people. I try to talk to them, and I think if you just say every dollar that you spend you don't have that you got to pay back, we pay our system by taxes.
Good point. Good point, Armin. What was your question about Putin?
Okay, about Putin. It was kind of cute. They had him, I think it was on MSNBC, about free media.
Yeah.
And why don't you suppose that Putin, when they were inquiring him about a free media over there, why don't you think he turned to the cameras and says, how can the Bush crime family gain political mileage if our media in the former Soviet Union or Russia is freer than the American censored press?
Yeah. Putin had some, apparently he had some real barbs ready that, if Bush came after him, he was going to say, well, what about the 2000 election and what about the corporate control of media in your country? And, he had these answers ready, but apparently none of them got used. I think that they got leaked and the Bushies figured, we really don't want this discussion to happen. And so there was all this, make good, kiss, kiss. So I suspect that this whole thing. That for weeks, everybody has known how this was going to play out. And what we've seen is a very carefully choreographed performance. So the Bush gets to look like a tough guy. Putin gets to look like a Democrat. And everybody comes out of it looking the way that they want to. And it's plutocrats dancing with plutocrats. Armin, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I always appreciate it. It's plutocrats dancing with plutocrats. Nothing less. Time for... Come on, you.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be. It started when the government, in the midst of an economic crisis, received reports of an imminent terrorist attack. A former foreign ideologue had launched feeble attacks on a few famous buildings, but the media largely ignored his relatively small efforts. The intelligence services, however, knew that the odds were he would eventually succeed. But the warnings of investigators were ignored at the highest levels, in part because the government was distracted. The man who claimed to be the nation's leader had not been elected by a majority vote, and the majority of citizens claimed he had no right to the powers he coveted. He was a simpleton, some said, a cartoon character of a man who saw things in black and white terms and didn't have the intellect to understand the subtleties of running a nation in a complex and internationalist world. His coarse use of language, reflecting his political roots in a southernmost state, and his simplistic and often inflammatory nationalistic rhetoric, offended the aristocrats, foreign leaders, and the well-educated elite in the government and media. And as a young man, he joined a secret society with an occult-sounding name and bizarre initiation rituals that involved skulls and human bones. Nonetheless, he knew the terrorist was going to strike, although he didn't know where and when, and he'd already considered his response. When an aide brought him word that the nation's most prestigious building was ablaze, he verified it was the terrorist who had struck and then rushed to the scene and called a press conference. "You are now witnessing the beginning of a great epoch in history," he proclaimed, standing in front of the burned-out building surrounded by national media. "This fire," he said, his voice trembling with emotion, "is the beginning." He used the occasion, "a sign from God," he called it, to declare an all-out war on terrorism and its ideological sponsors, a people, he said, who traced their origins to the Middle East and found motivation for their evil deeds in their religion. 2 weeks later, the first detention center for terrorists was built in Oranienburg to hold the first suspected allies of the infamous terrorist. In a national outburst of patriotism, the leader's flag was everywhere, even printed large in newspapers suitable for window display. Within 4 weeks of the terrorist attack, the nation's now popular leader had pushed through legislation in the name of combating terrorism and fighting the philosophy he said spawned it, that suspended constitutional guarantees of free speech, privacy, and habeas corpus. Police could now intercept mail and wiretap phones. Suspected terrorists could be imprisoned without specific charges and without access to their lawyers. Police could sneak into people's homes without warrants if the cases involved terrorism. To get his patriotic decree on the protection of people and state passed over the objection of concerned legislators and civil libertarians, he agreed to put a 4-year sunset provision on it. If the national emergency provoked by the terrorist attack was over by then, the freedoms and rights would be returned to the people, and the police agencies would be re-restrained. Legislators would later say they hadn't had time to read the bill before voting on it. Within the first months after that terrorist attack, at the suggestion of a political advisor, he brought a formerly obscure word into common usage. He wanted to stir a racial pride among his countrymen. So instead of referring to the nation as the nation, or even the fatherland, he began referring to it instead as the homeland. The word he used actually was Heimat, homeland in German. And his number two man, Rudolf Hess, introduced it in 1934 at a rally in Nuremberg. Listen for Heimat.
Dank ihrer Führung.
Thanks to the Führer.
Wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen, Heimat zu sein.
Yeah, the Heimat for all Germans, all over the world.
Heimat zu sein für alle Deutschen der Welt.
His propaganda minister orchestrated a campaign to ensure the people that he was a deeply religious man, and that his motivations were rooted in Christianity. He even proclaimed the need for a revival of the Christian faith across his nation, what he called a new Christianity. Every man in his army wore a belt buckle that declared, "Gott mit uns," God is with us. And most of them fervently believed it was true. He proposed a single new national agency to protect the security of the homeland, consolidating the actions of dozens of previously independent police, border, and investigative agencies under a single leader. To consolidate his power, he concluded that government power wasn't enough. He reached out to industry and forged an alliance, bringing former executives of the nation's largest corporations into high government positions. A flood of government money poured into corporate coffers to fight the war against the Middle Eastern ancestry terrorists lurking within the homeland and to prepare for wars overseas. He encouraged large corporations friendly to him to acquire media outlets and other industrial concerns across the nation, particularly those previously owned by suspicious people of Middle Eastern ancestry. He built powerful alliances with industry. One corporate ally got a lucrative contract worth millions to build the first large-scale detention center of the enemies of the state. Soon more would follow. Industry flourished. He also reached out to the churches, declaring that the nation had clear Christian roots, that any nation that didn't openly support religion was morally bankrupt, and that his administration would openly and proudly provide financial support to initiatives based on faith.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run.
He built powerful alliances with industry. He reached out to churches. In this, he was reaching back to his own embrace of Christianity, which he noted in an April 12, 1922 speech. My feeling as a Christian points me to my Lord and Savior as a fighter. It points me to a man who once in loneliness, surrounded by only a few followers, was greatest not as a sufferer, but as a fighter. In boundless love as a Christian and as a man, I read through the passage which tells how the Lord at last rose in his might and seized the scourge to drive out of the temple the brood of vipers and adders. When he later survived an assassination attempt, he said, "Now I am completely content. The fact that I left the Burkhaukeller earlier than usual is a corroboration of Providence's intention to let me reach my goal." Many government functions started with prayer. Every school day started with prayer. And every child heard the wonders of Christianity, and especially the Ten Commandments, in school. The Ten Commandments were elevated, the Sermon on the Mount diminished. The leader even ended many of his speeches with a prayer, as he did on February 20th, 1938, before Parliament. I won't read you the whole prayer. It's rather long. Anyhow, with his number two man, he began a campaign to convince the people that to convince his people that a small, limited war was necessary. Another nation was harboring terrorists. He needed to attack them. When he attacked Austria, afterwards, he said, "Certain foreign newspapers have said we fell on Austria with brutal methods. I can only say even in death they cannot stop lying. Not as tyrants have we come, but as liberators." Another technique was to manufacture news through the use of paid shills posing as reporters, seducing real reporters with promises of access to the leader in exchange for favorable coverage, and thinly veiled threats to those who exposed his lies. As his propagandist minister, Joseph Goebbels, said, "It is the absolute right of the state to supervise the formation of public opinion." A year later to the week, Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia. 3 months later, he claimed Poland had weapons of mass destruction and attacked Poland. And now you know.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio, Tom Hartman Radio Program. The third hour of our program on this beautiful 24th day of February, 2005. Our quote for the day from J. William Fulbright: "In a democracy, dissent is an act of faith." Today, on this day in history, we call it Null and Void Day. Well, by the way, and for those who, a couple of people called and some people dropped in the chat room asking the question, what I was sharing with you in the previous hour was from a piece that I wrote originally. I wrote the first draft of it 3 years ago, right after 9/11, and is published as a chapter in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? And is I update it every year and reprint it or reoffer it on the web. It's on. It was published on commondreams.org this week. If you go to www.commondreams.org, or if you go to tomhartmann.com and just click the link that says Articles on Democracy, it's the top article. It's called When Democracy Failed. That's what I was sharing with you. On this day in history, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 1803 that an act of Congress was null and void because it conflicted with the U.S. Constitution. Now, this is a really interesting little tidbit of history for those of you who are fascinated by history. I just got to share it with you. In the United States Constitution, the Constitution of the United States, it does not say, nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court of the United States has the ability to overturn legislation passed by Congress and signed by the president. It does not say that. And, in fact, a lot of constitutional scholars believe, and certainly Thomas Jefferson believed, many of the founders believed, that when the Supreme Court was defined in, as I recall, Article 3 of the Constitution, if my recollection is right, Article 1 is Congress, Article 2 is the presidency, and Article 3 is the... I may be wrong. Anyhow, one of those first three articles of the Constitution. When the federal judiciary and the Supreme Court was defined, it was viewed as a court of last resort. In other words, if you sued somebody in a lower court and you didn't get what you thought was fair satisfaction, you could go to the state courts, and if that didn't work, you could go to the federal appeals court, and if that didn't work, you could take it to the Supreme Court. And that was the Solomonic court, right? That was, you know, the people would go to King Solomon and say, you know, we can't get this dispute resolved any other way. What should we do? Well, cut that baby in half. And then the one woman who's really the mother says, oh, no, that's, please don't give it to her. And then he knows who, you know, it's these marvelous stories from history, from the Bible and from other sources about the court of last appeal. And so the Supreme Court was originally viewed as a court of last appeal, not as a court that could overthrow or overturn or overrule the president or the Congress. And John Adams' final act of office on his way out of town in 1800 as he was leaving the presidency, handing it off to Thomas Jefferson. And in fact, there was some doubt at that time. They refer to this as the Revolution of 1800 because there were a lot of people who thought Adams wasn't going to leave and that there was going to be a battle because Adams and Jefferson were so, so diametrically opposed on so many things. Jefferson was the vice president under Adams, you'll recall, and he left town when Adams signed the Alien Sedition Act. These men were hardly speaking to each other by 1800. And Jefferson ran for president and ousted Adams. So anyhow, as Jefferson comes into office, the last thing that Adams does before he leaves, one of the last things he does, is he appoints Jefferson's cousin, fellow by the name of John Marshall, who was a hero of the Revolution, fought in the Revolutionary War, a well thought of lawyer and judge, but a conservative. If they called him Federalists back then, and a what you might today call an extreme conservative, appointed him Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, where he sat for another 25 or 30 years. Marshall, my recollection is that he was Chief Justice until like 1830, 1835. That 35 years, a long time he sat on the Supreme Court as Chief Justice. And in 1803, there was this case that involved James Madison, who would be the next president of the United States. He was, what was he, Secretary of State under Jefferson? I don't recall. In any case, that would involve James Madison and a fellow by the name of Marbury. In fact, the case was called Madison versus Marbury that came before the Supreme Court. And in that case, Justice John Marshall, the Supreme Court Chief Justice, in that case, in 1803, ruled from the bench that he had the authority to overturn a law that had been passed by Congress and signed by the president. And Thomas Jefferson went ballistic. He went absolutely nuts. He wrote a letter to Spencer Roan, who was the son-in-law of Patrick Henry and the justice of the Virginia Supreme Court, a close friend of his. And this is Thomas Jefferson writing now in 1803. If this opinion be sound, then indeed is our Constitution a complete fellow de se, which is Latin for legally a suicide. For intending to establish three departments, coordinate and independent, that they might check and balance one another, it has given, according to this opinion, to one of them alone, that being the Supreme Court, the right to prescribe rules for the government of the others, and to that one, too, which is unelected by and independent of the nation. The Constitution, Jefferson wrote, on this hypothesis is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please. It should be remembered as an axiom of eternal truth in politics that whatever power in any government is independent is absolute also. In theory also at first, while the spirit of the people is up, but in practice as fast as that relaxes. Independence can be trusted nowhere but with the people in mass. In other words, he's saying the Supreme Court is independent of the people. They don't have to run for re-election. You can't trust them. You can only trust the people. Independence can be trusted nowhere but with the people in mass. They are inherently independent of all but moral law. My construction of the Constitution is very different from that you quote. It is that each department is truly independent of the others and has an equal right to decide for itself what is the meaning of the Constitution in cases submitted to its action, and especially where it is to act ultimately and without appeal. And Jefferson wrapped his letter up saying, a judiciary independent of a king or executive alone is a good thing, but independent of the will of a nation is a solecism, an error, a blunder, at least in a Republican government. But on this day in 1803, John Marshall ruled that Congress could overrule the House and the Senate and the President, and it has stood ever since then. Over Thomas Jefferson's loud objections. He was president of the United States at the time. And we've seen the good side of it and the bad side of it. We've seen the bad side of it in things like the Supreme Court decision, Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, that established legal apartheid in the United States. The 1873 case, Bradwell versus State, that established that women did not have rights in the United States. The 1854 the case that ratified slavery. I'm forgetting the name of it. It's, in any case, we have seen the good and the bad. Some, and you know, on the other side, some would say 1973 Roe v. Wade, was that good or bad? I would say that it was a good thing, particularly because it gave women rights under the Constitution. It was really a Fourth Amendment case, not an abortion case. But nonetheless, there are those who say that should be the function of lawmakers, not judges. Not deciding whether women have rights or not, but whether abortion is legal or not. In 1954, the positive side of it, again, in my opinion, and I'd say the opinion of most Americans now, but certainly not at the time, 1954, Brown versus Board of Education. So the Supreme Court, this is why the Supreme Court is so important. Now, wasn't in 1802, but has been since 1803, because on this day in history, a good old Judge John Marshall, Chief Justice John Marshall, the first cousin of Thomas Jefferson and sworn enemy for life, ruled that he, as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, could overrule the President and the House of Representatives and the Senate, which were elected by the people. At least the House was at that time. The Senate was not elected by the people until 1917, but anyhow, you get the idea. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. TomHartmann.com, the website, if you want to drop into the chat room. Take a few phone calls here. Logan in New York on the line. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, I have a couple questions. I was wondering, is it possible for Bush to pass through this privatization scheme of Social Security without any support of Democrats?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. So, it only requires a simple majority in the House and Senate. And Bush would not try to veto his own legislation. I was going to say the overturn of veto requires a two-thirds majority, but that's not going to be a case here. So it's
likely that it's going to pass then.
Well, it's hard to say. There are a lot of Republicans who are very nervous about this thing. And the big the big issue here, Logan, is that the it that we're talking about has not yet been put out. We don't have any idea yet what Bush's plan actually is.
Well, and another thing is, can you explain or can you point to an article that explains how privatization of these accounts actually, what, that is the first step in the dismantling of Social Security? I don't think people really understand that.
Yeah, well, it's very simple and straightforward process. There's a number of excellent ones. Paul Krugman has written a number of great pieces in the New York Times, which I'm sure are reprinted. I know they've been reprinted on commondreams.org. So if you go to commondreams.org and search that site using Google or I don't know if they have a search engine on there or not, you'll find them. But Paul Krugman's columns on Social Security privatization are brilliant. And the guy's an economist, which adds a little weight to them. But there's no shortage of good pieces that have been written on this. The Center for American Progress as well has a number of good pieces on its website, AmericanProgress.org. But the bottom line is that the extent to which what they're trying to do is, first of all, they're trying to say Social Security is a retirement program. It's not. Social Security is an insurance program. It is designed to catch people who are falling through the cracks. The purpose of Social Security was not to provide for retirement. It was to prevent massive poverty among elderly and among those people who are the dependents of workers who can no longer work, or those who are workers who can no longer work. So if you, like my friend Michael in Santa Fe broke his neck, he's paralyzed from the neck down, he's living on Social Security. He's not retired. He's injured.
But Bush is saying that those people are going to be covered still. What's the next step? Is he going to do
the math doesn't work out. A third of Social Security recipients fall into that category of people who are getting benefits because they are injured or because they are the orphaned, you know, their kids whose parents died,
right, right,
or because they're the widows of workers. And so, you know, the math just, well, first of all, we don't see any math yet, but what math has been trickled out doesn't work out. What we're looking at is massive cuts in Social Security benefits over the years and a situation where if you're really rich, then the money that you put into Social Security, you'll get back and that'll be cool. And if you're in the middle class or the lower working class, you're going to be out of luck.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Logan. I appreciate that, too. It's the True People's Radio, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
You've got nothing left.
And welcome back. Yesterday, I've received an email from Carl in Ada, Michigan. And he said, yesterday I heard you say that you were for protecting the defenseless, the little guy, from the interest that would attempt to oppress and suppress him. I'll grant that it was probably not those exact words, but the intent, I believe, is accurate. Yeah, you're right, Carl. He says, at this time, one of the most defenseless among us is Terri Schiavo, and she's going to die a slow, terrible death if those of us who can speak remain silent. Actually, if she's received a death sentence, that could not be reversed. It would be more merciful, in my opinion, to simply give her a lethal injection than have her slowly die of starvation. This is a good time to speak out on behalf of those who can't speak for themselves. And he says, I imagine that your show is well-scripted and already set for your topics, but I'd like to hear you address this. Well, the show's not as well-scripted as you think, but yeah, I will address it. I'll tell you right up front what my position is on this. First of all, broadly, on the issue of physician-assisted suicide, and the only state in the union that has a law on this, which is the state of Oregon, I am entirely in support of that law. There are enough protections in that basically only people who are in absolute incredible pain and want to end their lives are going to end up with their lives ended. The Terri Schiavo situation, frankly, I'm baffled by this thing. Because in my opinion, it doesn't fall into that category. Here we have a woman who's in a persistent vegetative state. Her parents would argue that it's not quite that bad, but you know that let's it doesn't matter. You know whether it is or it isn't. For purposes of this of my argument on this, because her parents are willing to take her home and care for her for as long as she lives, whether she's a vegetable or not. And if somebody's willing to take care of her and take responsibility for her, then I would not be an advocate for for pulling the feeding tube on her. I mean, it just seems to me like, you know, here's, maybe there's no one home. Maybe there is. If there's, you know, maybe this is just some sort of quixotic, you know, venture on her parents' part, you know, some hopeful, you know, maybe it's even some weird kind of thing, you know, like people who have their cats stuffed after they die and then put them on the mantle. You know, I don't know. I can't look into the hearts of these people, but the fact of the matter is that she is alive. She's not in pain and they're willing to care for her. So I have no, you know, no problem with that. In fact, I think that they should be given custody of her. Maybe somebody can explain to me. I have, you know, failed to understand why her husband would have the final say in this matter, lacking a living will. I mean, basically what we have is we have his say, his going on the record saying that she said that if I'm ever a vegetable, please pull the plug. But we also have people saying that, well, you know, when this happened, the marriage wasn't all that good and bloody. I mean, it's such a messy situation. Now, Louise and I have both signed living wills. If either one of us ever gets in that condition, I mean, if I was in that condition, I would want Louise to pull the plug. If she really thought, in her best opinion, that there was, you know, no chance that I was coming back, please pull the plug. Or if I'm in intractable pain or something like that, you know, do it. But we don't have, and vice versa. That's her decision. But we don't have evidence. We don't have legal evidence of that in this case. And you do have the parents who are willing to care for their daughter. And therefore, you know, I'd say, you know, let her go home with mom and dad. You know, I just don't get it. Now, it may be that at some previous time, mom and dad weren't able or willing to care for her. And then, you know, her husband was faced with a different set of choices. I frankly don't know the history of the case that well to be able to pontificate about it. But that's my opinion on it. In response to the listener who took the trouble to send in an email about it and you know, ask my take on it. And I think it's a shame how this case is being demagogued by, particularly by the right, by the anti-abortion folks who are trying to tie this thing into the right to life. I mean, there is an issue here about, you know, assisted suicide, and it's a legitimate debate. But they're picking the wrong case, I think, for the debate to be held. This case is just too messy for any clean-cut answers. 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Let me add, we've stirred up the chat room here, and you know, one of the folks in the chat room, but her husband is the next of kin, and does the state have the right to butt in? And I agree, that's the really tough one. That's the really, really tough one. And if Terri Schiavo was on a ventilator, if she required equipment of any kind to stay alive, any kind of medical intervention to stay alive, then I would say her husband's say in the matter, assuming that, you know, experts are actually ruling that she's brain dead, should be the one that stands. But the reality is that all they've got to do is pour a little food and water into a tube a couple of times a day, and she's alive. She can be completely cared for by her parents. No doctors, no help, nothing. And they want to. So, I would say, if I were the judge, and I'm not, thank goodness, I would say, you know, let her go home with them, and realizing that it may be setting a precedent, but I don't think so, frankly, because I'm an advocate of physician assisted suicide. I'm an advocate of living wills. I'm an advocate of a system, the system that we have, where the next of kin can make these decisions when heroic measures are necessary to sustain life. But from what I understand of this case, heroic measures are not necessary to keep her alive. At least I don't define pouring some pureed food and water into a tube every day a heroic measure. It's something you know a 10-year-old can do. I don't see that as falling into that category under the law. And apparently a lot of judges haven't either, which is why this thing has been tied up for so many years in the courts. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Alex in New York on the line. Hey, Alex, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, I don't know if you've discussed this or not. There's so many parts of Bush's budget that we have to be careful about. Have you talked about the student loan situation?
I have not.
Okay.
Educate me, Alex. I know that there's cuts, but I don't know the details.
Right. Well, there was an article in the Village Voice in the New York area today about how he's trying to take... Right now, the student loans are capped at a very low interest rate. According to this article, they're taking the cap off of them, and they can go anywhere between 3 to 8.25%. If he passes this budget and he's able to do this, then a $20,000 loan, which usually pays about $7,700 in interest, they predict that the interest rate would go up to 7%, and you'd have to pay $17,000 in interest.
Over what period of time?
I think it's 10 years.
Yeah, I think isn't 7.5% the point where a 10-year note doubles?
I don't know about that.
It's my vague recollection from back in the days when I used to try and figure out mortgages and things. But I could be wrong. It might be 20 years. But in any case, yeah, okay, I got it. And see, one of the reasons why the student loans are capped at this low rate is because historically they have been guaranteed, and in fact very often actually even granted, but certainly guaranteed by government or agencies. And therefore they're saying to the banks, you know, you guys can make a little bit of profit on these things, but the big money that is made by banks, for example, on credit cards, we, the people, have allowed them to make those big profits because there's such a potential for losses. There's people who declare bankruptcy, people walk away, there's fraud, all these things. And so we say, okay, you can charge a higher rate because you're going to have losses. Same thing with mortgages. You're going to have a certain number of mortgages that are going to go bad, so you have to be able to not just make 1 or 2% profit, you know, and share with your stockholders and all that, but also another 2 or 3% on top of that for reserves, for the losses. But if the government is absolutely guaranteeing the loan so that there is no possibility of losses, then it's appropriate for we the people to say to the lending agencies, hey, you can only make 1% or 2% on these. And that's not, you know, you're not going to get rich, but you're not going to go broke on it either. And there have been banks always that have been, you know, willing to step into, and agencies, companies that have been willing to step into the fray and say, sure, we'll loan money with this, you know, guaranteed. It's like the railroads in the Monopoly game, you know, the utilities. It's, you know, you're not making a lot of money, but it's steady and it comes in, you know, and that kind of thing. And it seems to me that part of the whole Bush privatization Republican agenda is get the government out of student loans altogether. That's another form of nasty socialism. And this would, of course, be part of that, is just, you know, rendering them non-viable. And I would guess that if they're cranking up the interest rates, they're also doing away with those protections, that would be the rationale. Does the article say anything about that?
No, well, not really, but he tried to do this in 2002, and the Democrats rose up and defeated the bill. So I'm just encouraging all those people out there listening to you that are students, you know, for the average person, those loans, you know, they mean whether you can go to school or not.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's in your best interest to call up your congresspeople and say, you know, you can't let this happen.
Yeah, I agree. One of my kids is working on his master's degree on student loans right now. So
uh-huh.
I know what you're talking about.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
So, yeah, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Thanks, Alex, for the call. John in New England is on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Tom, hi. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, John?
Good show, as always.
Thank you.
You know, I was thinking about the things you were saying, and you say it's a paragraph in your book, and you quoted
with regard to what
to Hitler and how things, the scenarios.
Yeah, it's a chapter actually in What Would Jefferson Do.
You know, some of my Republican friends always ask me, like, where do you get this information? I say I get it from Tom Hartman. It's information that's, you know, disseminated to the public. You just have to look for it because it's not being, you know, said over commercial TV, radio and TV. So you know, I keep asking myself, I think of like Paul Wellstone and people like him, that was sort of like, you know, like taken out of the whole scene that were doing good.
Yeah, and John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King.
Right. Do you ever have feelings like that of being afraid? I mean, because your information is really, really good. You know, it's what we need. Have you ever encountered anything like that? Because you're
John, there's millions of people listening to you. Yeah, I know. Well, there's not millions, but there's hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
I get, at least according to the ratings, I get death threats fairly regularly in email. Yeah, and I've got there's two bullet holes in the side of my car right now. Somebody shot up our car about 6-8 months ago.
Wow.
But the answer to your question is no. I frankly, you know, I'm not expecting an Alan Berg moment. You know, Alan Berg was the liberal talk show host who was machine gunned to death by a couple of white supremacists in 1986.
Right, I remember.
Paving the way for the rise of Rush Limbaugh a year later. And, no, it comes with the territory. I mean, I was writing a long time before I was doing radio, and I was getting death threats when I was writing. I have friends on the right, believe it or not, and know people on the right in the media who also get death threats from people on the left. And, you know, it's just, there's always going to be people who are going to, you know, say things. They just go over the top. And occasionally somebody will make some symbolic act, like driving by, you know, our house and shooting out the windows of my car and, you know, like
wow.
that. And, but, you
I
know,
just
I
never realized you were in such a, you know,
but
situation like
well, I really don't, you know, I mean, there's a huge difference between acting like a fool and making threats or even acting stuff out. I mean, you know, I remember when I was 12, 13 years old, when I was a kid and I was, you know, up visiting my cousin up in northern Michigan. And one night, you know, a bunch of us boys got together and had too much to drink. And we were all like really young teenagers and we went out and slashed some guy's tires in his car. You know, I mean, you know, vandalism happens. And I don't take it personally. I don't think that those people would have shot at that car if I was in it.
Well, I meditate on your wellness all the time.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it, John. But, I'd rather not put out too much more beyond that.
Okay, Tom.
Thanks for the call.
Keep up the good work.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye-bye.
You too. I do appreciate it. 17 minutes before the hour. And Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see. The Death with Dignity stuff. I have just a pile of stuff here. But I think, you know, I think I've really just kind of set it. You know, it's enough. We don't need to go any farther on that thing. Terry Schiavo and all this. This is another. Here's another example. Now, here's the case of Terry Schiavo. I'm suggesting that the government should actually interfere in the lives of private citizens. That is to say, her husband wants to stop feeding her. If she was in his care and he was the guy who had to pour the slurry into the tube every day to feed her, he would stop doing it and she would die. And so the state stepped in and said, okay, well, we're going to feed her. And he's saying, well, no, stop feeding her. You know, I mean, that seems to be, to me, how it's shaking out. And theoretically, he should have that right to decide whether she lives or dies. Or legally, actually, he does. He should have that right, I think, by and large. And yet there are these exceptional cases, and I think hers is one, where I think it's appropriate for a government to butt into our lives. There are others where I think it's highly inappropriate. An eminent domain is a big one. And this just went before the Supreme Court. And this is something that I think we all need to be paying attention to. I doubt that most Americans had any idea how extensive the use of eminent domain had become as a consequence of corporate activity. The Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, let me just share this with you very quickly. It says, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on presentment of the indictment of grand jury, except in cases arising in the naval or land forces or in the militia, but in actual service in time of war or public danger. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be put twice in jeopardy of life or limb. So the first part is, you know, you have to have an indictment. There has to be, which means that the holding in Guantanamo is nonsense, although they say except in cases arising in the militia, so that's that they're saying that they're out. But in any case, nor shall any person be subject to the same offense twice. That's double jeopardy. nor shall he be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. That's the famous, I take the fifth. Nor to be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Okay, that's, in other words, you have a recourse to the courts. And then this very last phrase of the Fifth Amendment, this is the one that has caused no end of mischief here recently. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Now, that's all it says. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Now, what they're saying in that is there's a real critical word in there, and that's public. And they say, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. What they're saying essentially is, if you need to build a road and there's a house in the way, you're going to have to pay that homeowner. But the need of society for the road outweighs the right of the homeowner to keep their home. But you have to compensate them. If you're going to build a fire station and you have to tear down a house to do it, you're going to have to pay somebody for that house. Or you're going to build it on their land, you're going to have to pay them for the use of their land. If you're going to build an airport, if you're going to build some public facility, obviously the founders were thinking of airports, but railroad station, I'm not sure to what extent they were thinking of railroads even. The first railroad in the United States, as I recall, was in 1806. The Baltimore and Ohio had, in fact, the first president to ride on a railroad was Jackson. So that was the 1830s. In any case, but I digress. So the law says, or the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution says, that they can't, that we the people collectively, that is government, cannot take away from us individually, that is private property. They cannot take our private property unless we are compensated and unless it's for public use. Now, many communities have come up with creative definitions of public use. And they're saying that if it's a big corporation and they're going to pay more taxes, that's a public use. And it turned this from the Washington Post, this article by Charles Lane about this argument before the Supreme Court. An attorney for a group of Connecticut homeowners told the Supreme Court on Tuesday that his clients have a constitutional right to stay in their houses, even though their city says it needs the sites for privately developed offices, hotels, and parking in a case that could affect property rights nationwide. You get this now? This is remarkable. When Wesley Horton rose to argue on New London's behalf, this is on the city, O'Connor, this is Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, asked whether it would be okay for the city to replace a Motel 6 with a Ritz-Carlton if the city felt Ritz-Carlton would pay more tax. Horton said yes, prompting justices to pepper him with questions about the basic fairness of shifting resources from one set of private property owners to another richer set. See, this is what's going on. Between 1998 and 2002, more than 10,000 threatened or filed condemnations involved a transfer of property from one private party to another private party in 41 states. What is happening is that communities are looking at private property. They could come and say, look at my house and say, you know, that's a nice house, but you only pay us $2,600 a year in property taxes. And if we build a McDonald's where your house is, they would pay us $5,000 a year in property tax because commercial use makes more money. So therefore, and McDonald's would like your space, by the way, so we're going to take your house. Now, first of all, it's probably not going to happen here in Montpelier, Vermont, because we're the only capital city in the United States without a McDonald's. We've been fighting them for years in the courts, but you get the drift. And this is now before the Supreme Court. Over 10,000 times. Between 98 and 2002, big corporations have gone in, or land developers have gone in, wealthy folks have gone in and said, if you will take this private property away from private people, in many cases small businesses, if you'll condemn that small business, we will put a great big shopping mall there, we'll put a Walmart there, and we'll generate more tax dollars than that small business will. And the local community has said, okay, cool. I don't consider that a public use. I'm sorry. This just seems wildly unconstitutional to me. It seems absolutely wrong. Let's keep track and see how the Supreme Court rules on this one. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
If there's something you found to believe in, then the message must get through.
As passed the word along, the Senate Democratic leadership is passing along a letter, circulating a letter, calling for other senators to join a call for an investigation into the Jeff Gannon story. The letter issued from Minority Whip Richard Durbin of Illinois, Democrat of Illinois, calls on President Bush to order a full inquiry into how a fake journalist working for a sham news organization got access to the president. The decision to take action on Gannon has been brewing for about a week since Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey called on the White House to turn over all documentation relating to Gannon's credentialing. And finally, well, I leave you with this one last thing here as we are wrapping up the evening. I would, perhaps tomorrow, I would love to hear from our listeners in California about your take on this. There's really not time for phone calls here because we're toward the end of the show, but I got this email from a California resident. I was in California when your Secretary of State, Kevin Shelley, announced that he was going to resign. I was in Palm Springs speaking at a conference. In fact, I did my show live from there, the Winter Brain Conference. And I read about it in the newspaper, and it seemed like he was, you know, kind of, well, let's say he didn't get the best press, and that maybe there was a good reason for his resigning. But this person sends me this email saying, I wish you would weigh in on the forced resignation of California's Secretary of State. I didn't realize it was forced. What's at stake? She says, vote stealing plus Texas-style redistricting. Kevin Shelley has been smeared in the corporate-owned media and has been attacked relentlessly by the right. His crime? He stood up to Diebold. He decertified Diebold machines and sued the company for false claims. And she says, first, they went after Gray Davis and took over the governorship with Arnold. Then they went after Kennedy, Kevin Shelley, and forced him to resign. Third, they will install an RNC-compliant Secretary of State who will take control of California's voting system. Fourth, they will mandate electronic voting without paper. The bill is already. The campaign has begun. Fifth, they will redistrict California as was done in Texas. And sixth, California will become a red state. Seven, game over. If we don't save California's electoral system from takeover, the battle for our votes will be irreparably set back. I find this interesting. She gives this phone number, 916-653-7244. Apparently, this is the phone number of the California Secretary of State's office, and says, you know, call and say that, you know, you support Kevin Shelley, actually. 916-653-7244. And she also notes a defense fund has also been set up for him as these attacks are destroying him financially as well. I am fascinated by this, and as I said, I would love to hear from the folks in California what your take is on this, perhaps tomorrow or later on, you know, next week in the program as time goes on. But could it be that there is a conspiracy afoot in California to get rid of the Secretary of State simply because he dared to take on Diebold Corporation and replace him with somebody who will put in those Ohio and Florida-style voting machines and rig elections in the future? Could it be? I don't think you have to be paranoid to think so. I really don't. It's News Without Conflicts of Global Corporate Interest, the Tom Hartman radio program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. Thanks for being with us today. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.